Why, today is a day that Americans should celebrate just as much as we celebrate the 4th of July. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principal Policy. And along with me today is my good friend, co-host, Vice Chairman of our Policy Institute, and fellow analyst, Chuck Michaels.
And it's good to be here again, Barry, and you're sounding good. This is a kind of an interesting and important topic, so let's get to it.
Yeah, well, we teased a little bit on our weekday program, Friday at 5:30, about today's program, because people would be sitting there thinking, okay, it's January the 14th. President's Day, no, that's in February. Martin Luther King, no, that's next, that's Monday. What is the 14th? What day is it? Well, Chuck, for our listeners, we should be celebrating, and we should probably be doing it with fireworks and picnics and maybe even snowball fights since we are in January. It's Ratification Day. You see, Chuck, because on January the 14th, 1784, a few years after the Declaration of Independence, I know, but on January 14th of 1784, the Congress of the Confederation, and that was the Americans under the Articles of Confederation, signed a document, and that document was called the Treaty of Paris. Treaty of Paris was the agreement of the cessation of hostilities between Great Britain and the American colonies. It ended the American War for Independence. And Ratification Day is the day that it became official. When the American Congress ratified the document, it became the law of the land. And therefore, America, the colonies, were recognized as, in the eyes of the world, as Jefferson had requested in the Declaration of Independence, had become free and independent colonies who should be recognized by their own station in the world by all other nations. And this document officially made that happen.
And I have to make one minor correction.
Please.
They became free and independent states.
States, that's right. You're right.
Free and not independent. Colonies.
That's right.
What the whole fight was about.
Yes. That's correct. And you corrected me. I should have thought of that. But basically, this document was signed in September the 3rd of 1783 by the delegates from America, who included Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Jay. The British consulate, the member of parliament, was David Hartley, who represented King George III. And this was signed in Paris, France, on that day. Now, it took from September 1783 to January 1784 for the document to get back to America and for the Congress of the Confederation to convene and take up the document and review it. And Chuck, I just think it's very, very interesting because if we went and asked people on the street, even if we asked people in our Institute on the Constitution courses what's important about January the 14th, I doubt seriously if more than 10% of the people you ask would know that it's Ratification Day, because we just don't pay any attention to it, not as much as we do Independence Day.
Well, I'm going to have to say mea culpa. I didn't know today was the 200 and... 238th anniversary of the ratification of the Treaty of Paris. I had no idea. I knew, now I'm historical enough that I knew that the treaty was signed by the delegates in November of 1783, and I would have assumed it would take at least 6 weeks. A winter crossing by sea was generally about 6 weeks in 1783. So I assumed that it got here sometime, maybe December, late December, early January. I had no idea how long it took Congress to bang out some things. I know there was some rancor in Congress over some of the provisions of the treaty, but nobody had much taste for renegotiating some of the things that were they didn't really like in the treaty.
No, so, because they didn't want to open that back up again and possibly cede some ground. Honestly, the provisions of the treaty were fairly generous to the American states in relation to the expansiveness of the territory that they gained from the victorious revolution, which we honestly, it wasn't a revolution, it was a war for independence. And you know what? You get to correct me, I get to correct you. Let's redo the math. It's 228 years, not 238. So
yeah, thank you.
Welcome.
Matt, if I couldn't use higher math, I couldn't use calculus to figure that out, so I couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. I had to get a slide rule and an abacus in order to make sure I had that right.
You can laugh about that, bud, but I used to carry a slide rule. I'm old enough.
Well, we've just told our entire audience a little bit about your background.
Yeah, I didn't have a pocket slide rule, but I had one, and I knew how to use it at one time.
Yes. Well, you know, Chuck, with this document, with the Treaty of Paris, the main body of the document was what was called the 10 Articles, because there were 10 provisions in the Treaty of Paris that spelled out the particulars of what was going to be recognized and who was going to be recognized and what boundaries were going to be recognized. But the most important things that were recognized, first of all, occurred in the preamble, because in the preamble it declared that the treaty was made in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. Now, for those folks who want to say today that, well, America was never a Christian nation, and they want to point to the Treaty of Tripoli and George Washington dealing with the Muslims of the time, I want to point to the Treaty of Paris, which meant the world recognized the American states as free and independent, and the fact that the treaty which caused that to be legitimized and acknowledged was done in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. And I don't think they were talking about Great Britain, France, and the Dutch Republic. they were
probably not
talking about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. In other words, the Christian underpinning of even our foreign policies of that period cannot be denied. No matter how much writers like Kramnik and Moore and others who are rampant secularists, or the late Christopher Hitchens and others wanted to try to knock down the idea that America was actually formed as a Christian country.
Well, let's talk about that language for a minute, because that Treaty of Tripoli is very interesting. That treaty was actually abrogated at some point, and the offending language that the United States was in no way founded upon the tenets of the Christian religion was not in the second treaty that was signed. And in fact, it may not have been in the version of the treaty that the Arabs had, that the Tripolitanian. There is some question about the Othello. I'm a little rusty on the details, but I think if you go to wallbuilders.com, that's wallbuilders.com, that's David Barton's site. He has an article in there that goes into great detail on the Treaty of Tripoli. Let's talk about some other treaties. For instance, the treaty that ended the War of 1812.
Yes.
The treaty that ended the War of 1812 was also made in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. And that came, of course, in about, that was the Treaty of Ghent, and I think it was signed in 1815?
Yes.
1814 or 1815. And ratified in 1815.
Ratified in 1815, yes.
And now, does this mean, now, since the Treaty of Tripoli was, I think, in 1808, did we go from a Christian nation to not founded on the ideals of the Christian religion to back to a Christian nation between 1784 to 1808 to 1815? Well, the answer, of course, is no. We were always founded on the tenets of the Christian religion. And the fact is that the first Tripolitanian Treaty was not a treaty that was negotiated at the advantage of the United States of America.
No, it was not.
It was a treaty that was negotiated at the military advantage of the Tripolitanian leadership, the Pasha. And in order to not intimidate the Tripolitanian Pasha,
the Bay of Tripoli had more power than George Washington.
That's right. They had more naval capability. Then we did not have much of a navy.
Yeah, it's fairly obvious that the military advantage was toward the Muslims at that point. So the Bay of Tripoli had much more authority and ability to write those documents the way they wanted than George Washington did to write it the way the Americans would have had it.
Right, and that's because we basically had no real navy. We had sort of a merchant fleet, which was at the mercy of the Tripolitanian Pasha. So we had a negotiated treaty where we basically agreed to pay an indemnity so that the American sailors would not be kidnapped and sent into slavery in the Ottoman Empire.
We didn't want our Americans impressed into the service of the Muslims.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line in that case. Now, by the time we signed the second treaty of Tripoli, we had done what the Marine Corps hymn says, we had gone to the shores of Tripoli.
Yes.
And in fact, Admiral Decatur destroyed the Pasha's fleet at anchor. And basically Yes, that's right. Then the second treaty was highly advantageous to the United States of America. And in fact, it broke the back of the Tripolitanian Pasha in the Mediterranean and made the Mediterranean safe once again for American shipping. And it did not have those onerous, very disadvantageous phrases. And it also didn't have the thing where it said the United States of America was not founded on the Christian religion, because we didn't have to worry about making the Pasha mad anymore. We didn't care if the Pasha was mad anymore, because if he got mad, we'd just send the Marines back out. I think that speaks for itself. Using treaty language to prove the Christian nature of the founding of the United States of America is sort of a fool's errand anyway.
Hey, but that's what I was just doing with the Treaty of Paris. No, just kidding. But the point is that the fact is that that phrase in this particular treaty, I believe, pointed to the idea that this was a covenantal document, that it wasn't just done between Britain and the American states, but it was done between Britain, the American states, in the presence and in the name of, as it says, the most holy and undivided Trinity. So they both acknowledged that there was a higher law order that they had to follow. And I think we see that when we start looking into the 10 articles, because much of what was in the 10 articles is based on Christian principles of justice, such things as, and I'm going to get back to the main thing here in just a moment, because that's really the gist of what we want to talk about today in relation to our celebration of this day and our ratification day proceedings today. But basically, one of the things that they said were, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to recognize the lawful contracted debts to be paid to creditors on both sides of the war. So in other words, they were going to honor their debts. They also were going to earnestly recommend, the Congress of the Confederation would earnestly recommend to state legislatures to recognize the rightful owners of all confiscated lands and, quote, provide for the restitution of all estates, rights, and properties which have been confiscated belonging to real British subjects. Who are those real British subjects that they're talking about in America, Chuck?
The Loyalists.
The Loyalists, the Tories, if you will. As a matter of fact, 200,000 Loyalists had left the American states area during the war and had fled to places like Nova Scotia and other places. And their properties were confiscated by the Army, the Continental Army, and by the Congress. But basically, the Congress said, you know, we're going to recognize, because the Congress and the Confederation didn't have the authority, like our federal government does or thinks they do, to come in and tell the states what to do. They were going to recommend to the states, hey, it's over with. Can we restore these people back to what they had before? Because that wasn't the purpose of the late unpleasantness. It was to declare that we are free and independent states and that we take our place in the world as among the powers of the world, as Jefferson mentioned in the Declaration. And they basically also said that the United States will prevent future confiscations of the property of Loyalists. So in other words, through this treaty, they wanted to try to mend fences. They wanted to try to smooth it out and say, okay, now it's over with. We're a free nation, free states. Let's work to do things right.
And unfortunately, it didn't work out so well in practice, because one of the things that was supposed to happen in return was that Britain was supposed to abandon forts that they were occupying on the frontier, such as Detroit, some stuff along the Mississippi.
Right. Up and down kinds of things. In Indiana and in other places where they had forts, yes.
And there's another, if you look at Article 8.
Yes.
The navigation of the river Mississippi from its source to the ocean shall remain forever, remain free and open to the subjects of Great Britain and the citizens of the United States, neither of which had control of that body.
No, they did not.
That's it. The pass back and forth between Britain and, or France and Spain. But the fact is that Spain and France were the countries that had control of the Mississippi, and sitting around promising one another rights to navigation that you don't own is an interesting thing that that exists in this in Article 8 here.
That's right. That's right.
And in fact, that particular clause caused a lot of trouble later on when some intrigue came around with the United States trying to obtain, for instance, Louisiana and what they called Western Florida, which was the panhandle and parts of Mississippi and Alabama. And things got a little interesting. And then we mushroomed into Aaron Burr and all that nonsense, which is way too complex to go into here.
But, you know, at least the intentions are important because if you don't have good intentions, you definitely won't get good results. But
well,
even
that's
if you
right.
do have good intentions, you may not get good results.
Yeah, that's right.
it depends on the effort you're going to put into it. So all the things in these 10 articles, the most important, the fundamental one, and part of the reason why we need to not only celebrate Ratification Day, but take some time to think carefully about our country today and what we're going to talk about, is the first article, which says that the acknowledgement of the United States to be free, sovereign, and independent states. An acknowledgement not just by Britain, but by the world, that the United States wasn't a single entity, but was made up of free, individually sovereign, and independent states. And Chuck, you talked about that list of states that were part were
That's
listed
right.
in this. And that
Article
would be
one.
In Article 1. You want to read the list there?
I sure will. New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they are to be free, sovereign, and independent states. And the king treats them with them as such, and for himself, his heirs, and successors, relinquishes all claims to the government, propriety, and territorial rights of the same, and every part thereof. It's interesting to think about in these terms that, yes, they are free and sovereign, but their sovereignty is to the individual states. And the king is stating such. He is letting them go, each as a sovereign entity, not in their united capacity as such. That is an important consideration, becomes more important later on as we go into the creation of the Constitution and then the fights over what it means afterwards. But this is one of the most important things you can deal with here, and that is that the king recognized that they were sovereign and independent on the basis of their individual statehood.
And that's very important because that theme carried over into and beyond the debates on the Constitution.
Oh, absolutely.
So, but here, you know, obviously we understood that back in 1776, Thomas Jefferson mainly penned a document that we teach quite a bit about in our Institute on the Constitution courses called the Declaration of Independence, and where he spelled out that these states had the right to take their place among the powers of the earth and that they had to retain that sovereign. They had the sovereign right to do that. Sovereignty has been a key concept for America from the time of the colonists all the way up through and even beyond the American Civil War. Now, I think in our modern era, post-Civil War, obviously with the Reconstruction Congress and leading into the 20th century, we've lost that idea of the sovereignty of the states, but it's still in our documents. It's still in the Treaty of Paris. It's definitely still in the provisions of the Constitution of the United States, including the Bill of Rights. But, Chuck, why do people not see this anymore And why is it important that we educate people as to the idea of the sovereignty of the states in relation to not just the federal government, but obviously with relations with the world?
Of course, the United States, the reason the United States government exists is to provide service to the states. It is a government by states for states. When we forget that issue, when we forget the fact that not only the original 13, but the territories that were added later and then became states, like Ohio, were designed to really be more or less independent and operate independently and have trade in between the different states. Because, let's face it, Ohio doesn't make everything, and Ohio does have things to offer to other states that those states don't have.
Yes, we call it Ohio Proud, right? That's our.
No, that's right. Although, in our current condition, let's face it, the economy's in dreadful condition. Our manufacturing's in dreadful condition, and it's simply because, in part, we have bought into this idea that we are no longer a sovereign state, and that we're all one big happy family. Which we are from a national standpoint. I mean, we all stand together united in for the purposes of defense, diplomacy, and trade. But the fact is that Ohio's laws are different than Indiana's, are different from Michigan's, are different from Pennsylvania's, are different from West Virginia's, are different from Kentucky's. And the same for those states and their surrounding states. And there's a good reason for that. It's because we have slightly different cultures in each state. We have slightly different needs. We have slightly different sensibilities. We have slightly different belief systems. And the fact is that we want to be able to vote with our feet if necessary and go to a place that has a different set of values, if you will, that more meet our needs. And we don't want one big giant sovereignty, overarching sovereignty, to wipe out that individuality. We want to keep that individuality intact, and yet still protect the rights and responsibilities of everyone under the national umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so that is being lost, Barry. We're being told that we're exactly the same as New Orleans, Louisiana, San Francisco, California, Butte, Montana, International Falls, Minnesota, Miami, Florida. And the fact is, all you have to do is get on a plane and fly to those places to find out just how really different they are.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Chuck, I'm going to say, you know, just up front for everybody, I'm prejudiced, and I embrace that. My prejudice is toward my own home state. You know, I've been an Ohioan since I was born. And I love this state. I've been to a number of other states, a number of the regions of the country. And honestly, I just can't see any reason why I would ever want to be somewhere else. But, you know, if the federal government were to come in and say, well, Ohio must have the exact same laws, rules, regulations, restrictions on liberties as, say, California does. I'll even go to California because I think there's quite a bit more there. New York's a good example as well. You know what?
Massachusetts. You know what? Okay, let's say Massachusetts. Yeah.
Yeah, Massachusetts as well. I don't live in New York, California, or Massachusetts because part of the reason is I don't agree with some of the policies of those states.
Right.
They may have some wonderful areas and beautiful scenery and majestic mountains or whatever it might be, or the California coast, or going to the beaches. But that's not my preference. See, I'm prejudiced. Oh my goodness, I think, Chuck, I discriminate.
No.
Well, it's kind of funny that I'm bringing this up because in the last couple of weeks I've been talking to my IOTC class about prejudice and discrimination and how they've become totally pejorative terms. But they're not. If you look at the baseline of the definitions of these words, not from the modern or postmodern, I should say, dictionaries, but from, say, something like a Webster's 1828 Dictionary of the American Language, to be discriminatory meant that you made decisions between things as to your preferences.
That's right. For instance, I discriminate in favor of my wife against all other women.
And you should, too. And the day you stop doing that is the day your wife is going to discriminate between you and a bullet.
Well, that's right. She will discriminate between me and a 50-yard target.
50-yard target. That's right. That's what I'm trying to get at. Thank you.
And actually, I will deserve that particular discrimination. But that being said, I discriminate every day against one in favor of one supplier against another for certain goods that I may need. I discriminate against one seller of gasoline against another one for various reasons. Discrimination is not necessarily bad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it can be, like anything else, it can be abused. And the same thing can be said against prejudices. I'm sort of prejudiced against evil, despite the fact that it's in my mind constantly, like because I am a sinner like every other man. The fact is that I do my best not to commit them because I am prejudiced against it and I am discriminating against it.
Well, you know what? I'm prejudiced against liver and onions and I discriminate toward prime rib. Okay, you know, but the point is, those words are common usage words. But what we're trying to get at here is what it gets down to is if we didn't have the states having individual sovereignty to set their own cultures, to determine their own laws, and not be foisted upon them. Now, we've got this situation right now, Chuck. We're kind of segueing here, but we have a number of states right now that, because of overarching federal laws and regulations, especially in the issues of firearms, you have a number of states, I believe Montana or Wyoming is probably the farthest along in this, who are passing bills to say that if a gun is manufactured within the borders of the state, totally within the borders of the state, and sold to a citizen of that state, that federal firearms regulations don't apply in that state. See, so some states in certain limited areas are attempting to re-exercise their sovereignty. They're attempting to say, this interstate commerce issue where the feds come in and tell us how to live and tell us whether or not we have to have, you know, instant check and 3-day waiting periods and concealed carry licenses and limited sizes of magazines and et cetera. You know, and the list goes on ad infinitum when you're dealing with firearms issues. Some states have said,
that's right,
enough's enough. At least in this limited area, they're saying, wait a minute, it's our rules in our state.
If you'll remember, I think it was last November or so, we did a series of shows in which we talked about the Interstate Commerce Clause and how it's been twisted through decisions like Wickard versus Filburn.
Yes.
Where a farmer grew 20 acres of wheat more than his quote unquote quota set by the federal government. And it didn't matter what he did, that wheat affected interstate commerce one way or another. And this was one of the things that is so infuriating is the corkscrew legal logic, and the federal government is already trying to use that to shut down these attempts by state legislatures like Montana's that are making this guns manufactured within their borders from parts made there are completely outside the purview of the federal government because they're not crossing state lines. They're making a big deal because you import the steel, you import.
You're raising a really good point. It's something I really want to make sure we point out to our listeners here. I took my class through the logical extent of this because that is the next step where the feds are now saying, oh, now, wait a minute. We still have control because the raw materials are not found in your state. And so, well, because the raw materials aren't in your state. But let's say you have one where, say, like Montana, where they can find the raw materials. And so they start going ahead and they start, you know, drawing their own steel and cutting it, stamping it in order to make their guns. And they have all the materials even to make, maybe they find a deposit of lead and they can make brass and the whole nine yards. So they can do everything from nuts to bolts in the state. Well, yeah, I took my class through this what happens next is the federal government comes in and says, oh, no, I'm sorry. The machinery you use to mine the raw materials,
exactly
manufactured in interstate commerce, and so therefore, and I used Wickard versus Filburn as my guide. Therefore, there's always going to be something unless the state says stop. Now, Chuck, you and I both know that there's only one way that the state can say stop, which would actually cease the federal government from having control.
Oh, well, that's nullification.
It's nullification. Well, there's a bigger step. I mean, really having control.
Oh, well, secession.
Secession. And ladies and gentlemen, right now, I'm not advocating necessarily for secession. But what I'm saying is there are states that are already looking at it. We know that New Hampshire has a very vibrant secession movement. Certain portions in the Carolinas are looking at it. Texas has always had it in their constitutions that they have the right to secede.
Actually, yeah, then not only that, they can split into five states.
Into five different states. That's
right. Yeah.
But the point is that, and I understand, most people think that after the Civil War, secession can't be done by a state, that they've lost the right to do so. But that's not necessarily the case now, is it, Charles?
Well, that's one of those questions that is supposedly, quote-unquote, settled. And as many of us know, questions settled at the point of a bayonet are very rarely actually settled to the satisfaction of anyone but the party who had the bayonet at the time.
That's right.
The party who was at the point of a bayonet generally still finds itself somewhat aggrieved of the outcome of the question.
Very much.
And those things tend to go to sleep and wake back up at times when suddenly everybody realizes, hey, you know, we had the bayonet, but there's a problem now because the bayonet is now pointed at our throat. It was, and a lot, I've heard a lot of people say, well, it was different back then. It's not the same now. It's different issues. And I'm like, it doesn't matter the issue. And this is why the nationalists always have to argue that the Civil War was fought over slavery. Again, we would point out that that's not correct. Slavery was part and parcel of the issue. In other words, it had to do with economics and constitutional interpretation, and slavery was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm, yes.
But in the North, the prejudice against people of color was at least as bad, if not worse, than in the South. And the fact is that the Jim Crow laws that are highly decried, and rightfully so, in the South, were the models for them were taken from Northern vagrancy laws. And very few people understand that, especially out of Illinois. And the person who helped get many of those vagrancy laws passed was Abraham Lincoln in his stint as a state legislator.
Mm-hmm.
So much for the idea that, you know, we get this goofy dichotomy, North good, South bad. No, the South had some bad things, the North had some bad things, and basically the question was really over the extent of federal power. And the South said they don't have this power, and the North said we do have this power, and basically it came to blows, and the North basically had to ignore a number of its own claims in order to defeat the South. In other words, for instance,
yes,
I realize this is going far afield.
We'll bring it back around. Go ahead.
You cannot blockade your own country. You cannot run a blockade against your own country. It is only a blockade unless you have a foreign country. It is a foreign country. And the fact is that the North blockaded the South and thereby admitted that the South was an independent nation.
Yes, with an independent capital. So yes,
that's right. And there are all kinds of things like that, and we talked about some of them, some of those things in earlier shows.
Sure.
But the whole point is that these things have what I think you called at one point in a recent show. They're more like spider webs.
Yes.
They don't emanate. They emanate from a central point, but they go to all over the place, and they each hold up a little bit of the weight. And for instance, you know, what did you say? I think the statistic you came up with was if a spider web were scaled up.
Yeah, well, it has the proportionate tensile strength. If you understand a spider web and what it holds, including the weight of the spider, if you would scale that up to the size of a rope, say like a cable that's less than 1 inch in diameter, it would hold up a fully loaded and fully gassed and fully cargoed jumbo 747. One strand.
And that's what we're talking about in this case. We've got this spider web that goes out all over the place, and all these things are hanging from it.
That's right. Well, you know, Chuck, and you brought up a point just a little bit ago, and you said that, you know, what will happen is you start bringing these issues up, and people say, well, there are different issues today. Well, I want to challenge that, and I know you've challenged that, because we go back to the Declaration of Independence.
That's right.
And the list of 27 grievances that the colonies had against the crown. And if you look at many of those, Chuck, it could have been drawn up yesterday.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just said in language that a lot of people don't fully grasp and understand today. But, you know, like the one provision about taxation without representation. Well, you know, yes, we do have representatives, but in many ways we're being taxed on goods and services, and we don't get a say in that.
Well, Barry, let me do a reiteration real quick of a point that I made when I was working solo.
Okay.
And I pulled 3 of the 27 complaints out because they had to do with the National Defense Authorization Act.
Okay, there you
go. And I marked them in my little book. All right, here's one. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance.
Yes, that's probably my favorite of the 27.
Yeah, and is that not Washington, D.C.'s regulatory agencies these days?
That is everything from the National Labor Relations Board to the IRS to the EPA. I mean, we could go on with the alphabet soup agencies of the federal government.
That's right. Department of Agriculture, you name one. Bureau of Weights and Standards in some cases.
And it's not so much even the, you know, the cabinet level offices as it is all of the sub-levels, and now we're even with this current administration, we're having new things called czars, which are have really no constitutional warrant, but is another level of bureaucracy in order to push the agenda.
Right. They're an independent. They're not a cabinet level. In many cases, they sit above a cabinet level position. Cabinet level agencies oftentimes have to report to a czar. There's no such warrant in the United States Constitution. Okay, let me read another one of these that I thought was important. And again, it relates back to the NDAA and could have been written yesterday. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Well, gee, is not that not the Enemy Expatriation Act coupled with the National Defense Authorization Act?
Coupled with NDAA, that's exactly right. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, right now, you know, you're listening to us, you're hearing these things, we're teaching them in our Institute on the Constitution courses, but it's not an academic exercise. You have to understand that what we're getting at here is many of the reasons that our founding fathers originally decided it was time to make a change, we could draw direct parallels to what's happening today in Washington, D.C.
And absolutely. Okay, now here's a third one. He has combined with others to subject us to a jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation.
Ah, the United Nations.
Well, not only that.
The World Court.
Well, not only that, Congress's usurpation of our state our state legislature's authority.
Yeah, that's true. There is that as well.
So all these things are complaints that are written about a tyrannical government in 1776.
Yes.
And here we are, 200 and what?
35 years later.
Yeah,
236.
236. Yeah, these high level numbers that we can't deal with. 236 years later, here we are, come full circle. We're dealing with some of the same issues.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reason we're dealing with them is because what they did in the Declaration of Independence was lay out a portrait of a tyrant, and a tyrant is going to apply the same abuses. It doesn't matter what time period you live in. It doesn't matter what century. It doesn't matter what country. The fact is, tyranny is timeless. It is a fixed definition, and the idea that these things, you know, it was a tyranny then, but it's not a tyranny now. It's probably one of the most absurd things I've ever heard in my life.
A tyrant is one who believes that they're above the rule of law and act in a manner to impose their will upon others rather than following true justice.
That's right.
Now, if that isn't a definition of modern-day Washington, D.C., not just the current occupant, but probably for quite a while now in our history, I'm not sure what is.
Well, I'd say since probably it got really bad after 1865, and it really got terrible around the turn of the 20th century. I'll be quite honest. You know this, and the people that listen. I'm not a big fan of Theodore Roosevelt. I keep hearing about the good Roosevelt. I'm like, well, I don't know which one that is. It's the one who apparently didn't run for any office because there isn't one. Theodore was a terrible progressive. And
yes, that term has the same connotations and intonations as the word progressive does today. It's a cloak for liberal.
And that's right. And this is the reason why this sovereignty issue is so very important.
Yes, it is.
If we don't recognize that the state of Ohio is a sovereign entity to which we have surrendered certain powers having to do with defense, diplomacy, and interstate and international trade to the federal government for our benefit, not for our detriment, for our benefit, then basically, Barry, we're never going to recover our liberty. And that's our goal, I think, in teaching our classes.
Well, Chuck, that's part of the reason why people are hearing our voices today on this radio program is because that's what Principles and Policies is all about. We want to help educate and inform our listeners so that they can understand the true basis of liberty. They can understand what our founders left to us, what the biblical frameworks and warrants are for these issues, and why it's important not to sit on the sidelines, not to be a spectator, not to let apathy win the next election, not to say that your elected officials are your masters, but your employees, to understand that there are checks and balances not just upon the branches of the federal government in our Constitution, but checks and balances between that federal power and the sovereign states, many of which we've allowed to be eroded these days, including with amendments such as the 17th Amendment with the direct election of senators. But those are issues where the progressive spirit has taken away necessary protections from the people. Yeah, in the guise of false liberty. And Chuck, that's the reason why I'm so excited about the fact that, you know, maybe even though it's still nascent and it's still in its infancy, we seem to be moving toward a reawakening of people who understand that the rule of law is important. And we have to get back to that, and we have to get back to the structures. And I'm not talking about we're going all the way back to the 1700s and, you know, everybody ride around in carts and, you know, and light your houses with candles. OK, so let's not be hyperbolic right. about that and engage in some false logical arguments. But but we have to get back to the framework that we were given. In other words, as the Bible says, do not remove those ancient landmarks which your forefathers have set. One of the best ancient landmarks we have in this country for liberty is the United States Constitution and the documents that surround it, the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation even, and even these treaties, like the Treaty of Paris, which we're talking about today, which was done in the name of the Most Holy Trinity and provided for the fact that we are independent and sovereign states. We got out from under the tyranny of one centralized government, whose ministry was in London, who sent officers in, including colonial governors like Thomas Hutchison in Massachusetts and other places, to eat out the substance of the people.
That's right.
Czars, and they're being sent in through bureaucratic agencies to eat out the substance of the people, whether it be in your families, in the education of our children, in our businesses, especially small businesses and small manufacturing and retail like you do, Chuck. These are areas where the assaults are coming fast and furious from a government that doesn't seem to know its boundaries, because we have a people who don't seem to understand their history and don't understand that they're it. The buck stops with the people. The people are the ones who draw the boundaries and call those elected officials, those people we employ. When you go vote for somebody, you're basically saying, I'm hiring you and I'm going to pay you out of my taxes, because that's how you pay a public official, is through tax dollars. So you're paying him with your taxes, so that money that he's raking in, whether it be the $400,000 plus a year that the president makes in salary, or the hundreds of thousands of dollars that congressmen and U.S. senators make, or whether it's the $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 a year that your state level officials are raking in, those are your tax dollars. You're paying them. You pay their salary. You give them the job with your vote. How are they doing? Have you done an employee evaluation lately? I think you should. We shouldn't wait to once every 4 years, and that's when most people come out and vote, Chuck. It's only during presidential elections.
Yeah, that's right.
Drop-off rate of voter turnout from a presidential election year to what we consider an off-election year, which is all the locals and maybe even a state-level election, is tremendous. There are times when people will only vote in once every 4 years and maybe once every 8 years. You know, we don't know, because people just are not engaging. Now, I think we've got a core group of folks who've decided we've got to get back in this. You know, we've got to restore the country. We have to stand up and have the voices be heard. Well, that's what principles and policies are about. We're trying to give a voice. We're trying to bring this information to the table. Now, I know, Chuck, you and I both know some people who I'd love to have as a guest on this program, and maybe we will, ladies and gentlemen, here shortly, who can talk about issues such as nullification, because you brought that up, Chuck, a little earlier, but I really would like to expand on that for our listeners here in the near future, because it's important, you know, to bring up even something like, well, I didn't realize you didn't know this, Chuck, that today is ratification day. You know, it's a momentous point of our history that nobody celebrates, that nobody pays any attention to.
And that's right, Barry. And there's a good reason for that. I think anyway.
I understand that, but
no, I think it has to do with, for instance, the controversy over a bill that you and I have both testified on.
Oh, yes.
Is illustrative of this. And in fact, there's still some kind of a struggle going on, because I read a piece written by Representative John Adams.
Yes, I did too.
Today. And I actually commented on it. I don't know if my comment was there when you read it or not.
Yes, it was. And I laughed out loud when I saw it.
But the fact is that we actually have sitting state representatives who oppose the teaching of the foundational documents of the United States of America.
Well, not just that, Chuck, because that bill also includes the teaching of the Constitution of the State of Ohio.
That's exactly right.
We have Ohio representatives and senators who are sitting there getting paid by Ohio taxpayers to write Ohio's laws, who oppose teaching children about Ohio's form of government, Ohio's the basic document in our state, and those in our nation with the Constitution, the Declaration, Northwest Ordinance, and the Federalist Papers.
Now, can you believe that one of them was a former teacher who squawked about the idea that he would be required to not only teach, but test on the what was in these foundational documents?
Yeah, well, and that was kind of shocking, because that particular, and we've talked about this on a previous program, you know, that particular person was a government teacher.
That's right.
He taught government and history. Said, there's just no time to teach this, which, it's like, as I pointed out earlier, made our point exactly.
Exactly.
There's so much other stuff in the curriculum that honestly isn't vital, isn't necessary, but the thing that we should be teaching, and one of the things we should be teaching our young people, is an appreciation and an understanding of the foundations of our government. Because, you know, and I've said this before, and I say this in speeches, that outside our own self-focused choices within our own families, nothing has a greater impact on how we live our lives than government policies. You know, when we basically turn a blind eye and we're apathetic and we don't go vote, and then you sit and complain about it because, you know, so-and-so's in there and he's a bum and, you know, they're passing this stuff and how dare they, or even worse, there ought to be a law and you want them to pass something. yeah, that's even worse. But the point is that if you're not engaged, if you don't understand our form of government, if you don't pay attention, if you don't vote, you're voluntarily not having a voice, which means that when those freedoms and liberties that you are holding on to are taken away from you, don't be surprised. Because you know what? If you're not out there supporting other people's freedoms and liberties by voting responsibly and learning about our form of government, learning about our history, and learning about ways in which we need to have a voice, don't be surprised if nobody's will do it for you when things start going south.
And that's right, Barry. And this is highly illustrative of what's wrong right now. People don't like history. They don't like learning about these documents. And the reasons they don't like it is because they're told that they're not really connected with anything. We learn history as a series of really unconnected events that have nothing to do with one another. You know, what's going on in Europe was isolated from what's going on over here.
Yeah, it's all a series of names and dates that you have to regurgitate
right.
on a page once.
And it's what liberals always call dead white men. And from that particular perspective, they're right. But where they're wrong is that, is there an overarching purpose? And as a Christian group, the answer is obviously yes. God has a purpose. He has a plan. I know I'm not an open theist. I am a Calvinist. And so I do believe that God has an overarching plan, and he has reasons for all these things that are going on. He allows from time to time the wheat to be separated from the chaff. And so he calls his remnant into himself and basically sends the rest to the fire. And I'm not talking about final judgment here, but I am talking about the fire being a form of judgment, not literally. But the fact is that once you understand that history is a tapestry that stretches out as far back as you can see, or further than you can see, and stretches ahead further than you can see, and that you are a thread in that tapestry, and you have been put there specifically by God for a specific purpose to give a certain texture or make a picture that he is building in this tapestry with his own hand. Once you understand history from that perspective, it makes it really interesting. How do these things all fit together? Why do they do things the way they do? I can remember being fascinated with a British series that came out in the late 1970s. And you probably remember this, Barry. It was called Connections.
Yes, I do remember that.
Did you ever
that.
Watch Connections? Was the most fascinating show I can ever remember watching, because he tied together without going to the religious aspect, because he didn't look at the at a purpose. What he proposed it as was a series of happy intermingling accidents.
Happy coincidences, well, yes.
That's right. And of course, as Christians, we all understand there is no such thing as a happy coincidence.
That's right. Things happen for a purpose. All things work together for the good of those who love God and who are called according to his purpose. Romans 8:28.
That's right. But the fact is that he made history fascinating because he showed how it all hooked up. How you go from the steam engine to the light bulb. You know, those kinds of things. How you how you went from one really seemingly unconnected thing to the flight to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing. And we need to recapture a curiosity about our founding documents, about our history, and not just our founding documents and our history, but our ancestors' documents and their history, and why it happened certain ways, and, you know, why things happen in history. We've all been thrown together into the United States of America, and I have one of our former students from camp who just basically jumped up and down and talked about how he hated the concept of American exceptionalism. And we need to get him back and say, well, oh, now hold on. The original concept of American exceptionalism had nothing to do with that we were God's chosen anointed. It had to do with our commitment to be God's servants.
Exactly.
And to stand as an example to the world of what would happen to a country that chose to serve God in the way he wanted to be served. And that is true American exceptionalism, not this idea that we're God's anointed and we can go around being the policemen of the world and imposing democracy on places that aren't psychologically, culturally, religiously prepared to have, you know, limited representative constitutional republics. This kind of government will not work every place. And every place that's tried it, who hasn't had the same set of values that we have, has failed.
Miserably.
Yeah, we have to keep that in mind.
Yeah, we do. So basically, ladies and gentlemen, what we're getting to today is know your history, especially the history of your own country. Make it a point. I don't care if you're 14, 44, or 84, make it a point to learn a little bit, just like we would say with Scripture, you know, memorize and put Scripture in your heart daily. But daily think about and work toward an understanding of the foundations of our country. Don't let the mainstream media or the talking heads, as we talked about the other day on the program, about using logical fallacies try to convince you certain things, because they're not necessarily going back to the roots. They're basically chopping at the branches. But the point is that if you're going to make change, taking it at the root is going to make a greater change than just taking it at the branch. So go back and look at the documents, read them. You know, do yourself a favor. They're very short documents, both the Declaration and the Constitution. They're not that many pages. Might take you 30, 35 minutes to read them. Most people spend more time reading the instructions on their video games or playing a video game than they do reading the documents that govern us and the by which our laws are made. It would seem that might be a little bit more important to us to understand and know. And so that way, when we get a runaway authority, whether it be Congress or the president or maybe even the judiciary, that it rings a resonant bell with you and you say, wait a minute, stop. You don't have the authority to do this. And maybe you see your elected official back home locally and you say, why did you vote in favor of that? Well, we needed it for this. Do you realize that the Constitution doesn't allow you to do that? Well, do you not stand for our Constitution? I thought you took an oath to uphold and defend it. Okay, you know what? If they want to defend it, if they don't want to be honest about it and say, okay, well, I lied, or it doesn't matter to me, or Nancy Pelosi, famous retort when asked about the Constitution, are you serious?
Yeah.
We need to, you know, we need to hold these people accountable. And it starts and stops with us. So do us a favor, start today, go out and celebrate Ratification Day. Grab yourself a copy of the Constitution and the Declaration and read it, or fire off some fireworks, whichever one makes you feel the best. Okay, but I definitely want you to come back on Monday at 5:30 and listen to Principles and Policies, because we're going to start another exciting week looking at more things that are happening in our country. Thanks for joining us, and you guys have a great weekend, and find yourself in a Bible-believing church tomorrow.